most busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Thursday, May 17th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org to get involved today. We really have an important set of interviews for you today. We'll speak again with Gabriel Saya of the Drug Policy Alliance and also with Ray Warren of the Marijuana Policy Project. We'll also speak with Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst today. This is rounding out our week of coverage of the busiest state legislative reform season really in history. Folks, again, visit the Take Action Center. We have links to it on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Visit the Take Action Center to get involved with local reform. Last November, we saw ballot initiatives happen all around the country. Lots of cities passed marijuana decriminalization ordinances. There were some state ballot initiatives as well. Folks, reform happens on a local basis. If we want national reform on marijuana and medical marijuana, it really is going to have to happen in cities and states first. Hey, that's part of the American democratic process. So get involved with democracy today. Get involved with marijuana politics. Visit the Take Action Center at normal.org. It's a full show today, so let's open up our stash right now. Today on the Audio Stash, we're going to have a jam-packed show full of marijuana policy experts. Gabriel Saya of the Drug Policy Alliance joins us again today, as well as Ray Warren of the Marijuana Policy Project. But we'll begin here today with Normal Senior Policy Analyst Paul Armentano. Paul tracks all of the legislation happening around the country related to marijuana and is the author of the Normal Report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids. Normal has sent literally thousands of copies of that booklet to Normal DPA and MPP local organizers who have in turn passed them on to hundreds of state elected officials. The Emerging Clinical Applications booklet brings together all of the significant scientific and medical research regarding cannabis, and it has been a major resource for information about medical marijuana used by organizers and again by politicians. You can download the full Emerging Clinical Applications booklet at normal.org, and we have links to it today on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Paul is a frequent contributor here to the Audio Stash, helping me edit the daily news items and our Friday news roundups. Paul, welcome back today. It's always great to have you here on the program.
Thank you, Chris.
Great to speak with you today, Paul. Let's jump right into the state legislative issues here with Illinois. Tell us about that campaign there.
Well, much to the disappointment of many, the Senate recently voted down a measure that would have enacted a state patient registry for authorized patients in Illinois who are using marijuana with their doctor's permission. And it was frustrating because this was a bill that had very strong public support, but it also had strong support from the Illinois Nurses Association. It had strong support from local clergy. It had support from much of the media. There was a sign-on letter of hundreds of attorneys as well as state and local doctors supportive of this measure. Really, you couldn't have asked for a broader coalition of support, yet unfortunately that did not influence a majority of senators to vote in favor of this common sense proposal.
You know, what is it about Illinois that is making this issue a tough pass for lawmakers there?
Well, if you wanted to simplify the vote, the most overt thing that jumps out at you is that while a majority of Democrat senators voted in favor of this proposal, only one Republican senator voted in favor of it. And that is just not the numbers you need to get legislation passed. Unfortunately, for better or worse, in Illinois, allowing patients access to medical marijuana and preventing them from being arrested for using this medication is seen as a partisan issue. In this case, it's seen as a Democrat issue, and Republicans were not going to buck that tide. And that's unfortunate.
You know, that is surprising, Paul, because, you know, around the country we see a lot of Republicans who are on the side of marijuana reform and sponsoring bills out there, especially when it comes to medical marijuana. You know, if anything, it seems that medical marijuana is becoming somewhat of a Republican platform issue and one to be proud of.
Most certainly, and clearly when activists and patients in Illinois go back to work in the next legislative session to try and once again pass this bill, there is going to have to be quite a bit of attention paid to getting certainly more Republicans and conservatives on board, because at this point that seems to be the only thing holding back the passage of this needed legislation in that particular state.
And also, the Illinois legislation was very comprehensive. It had these strict guidelines and restrictions on where medical marijuana could be grown and amounts patients could possess.
You know, at this stage in the game, anytime you are talking about a medical marijuana bill and going through the legislature, when you're talking about these sort of late stages in the legislature, we're almost always talking about well-written bills with strict guidelines to address the concerns of law enforcement and others who are worried about these laws potentially being abused. So that really is not an issue. Yes, this was a strictly worded bill, and those individuals who did not vote for it were not voting for it out of fear that somehow this was some loosely written bill that was not going to apply to simply the sickest of the sick. Those who voted against it had another agenda.
Now, Paul, let's take a look at Tennessee, where there was testimony happening this week regarding medical marijuana. We had a feature interview with Bernie Ellis of Tennessee here on the Audio Stash, and Bernie, of course, is a medical marijuana user there. So tell us about this legislation in Tennessee.
Both chambers are holding hearings this week. And in fact, Bernie Ellis, who was recently released from the halfway house he had been sentenced to, is actually before the legislature and testifying as we speak in favor of this bill. In fact, the original hearings were scheduled for last week, and the sponsors of the medical marijuana legislation actually postponed the hearings a week so that Bernie could testify in person in favor of the bill. There's also members of Normal's board of directors that are testifying before the legislature as well this week.
So, and what would this particular piece of legislation do there in Tennessee?
As written currently, it would be a fairly strict proposal that would allow certain qualified patients to use marijuana if they were authorized by their physician, and if they had received permission from the state to possess and use small amounts of marijuana for their medical use.
And Paul, last year we saw a lot of local ballot initiatives get passed in cities last November. Could there be some ballot initiatives in the works for this fall?
There is talk at this stage of a statewide initiative in Michigan looking at the issue of medical marijuana, and there could be other statewide initiatives, in the works in the coming months.
Well, Paul, this has been a great update here today. I really appreciate you joining us here on the Audio Stash.
No problem, Chris. Good to be here.
Paul Armentano is Normal Senior Policy Analyst. He's author of The Normal Report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids. You can read the report online with links we have at normalaudiostash.com. We also have links to Normal's Take Action Center so that you can get involved with local reform. Also joining us today to discuss marijuana law reform at the state level is Gabriel Saya of the Drug Policy Alliance. Gabriel is the director of the State Organizing and Policy Project at DPA. One of the most disturbing commonalities about marijuana prohibition in every state is the obvious racial disparity of arrests and incarceration, with Black and Hispanic Americans bearing the brunt of law enforcement's war on peaceful American marijuana smokers. We posed some questions about that racial disparity to Gabriel earlier this week. You know, Gabriel, even though we know that marijuana use is at the same rate in almost all ethnicities, because enforcement targets people of color, I have to ask, does it go too far to call the policies and those who seek to maintain prohibition that they're upholding a racist stance?
I mean, it certainly is when we consider that the people that are being locked up in droves under this, in many of our urban areas, are people of color. You know, if you take a place like New York City as an example, where, New York is a decrim state. I'm sure many of your listeners know this, where there was, I think it was 12 states in the 70s that passed, varying levels of decrim laws. So in New York, you can actually possess in your home, on your person, marijuana. I believe that it's up to 28 grams, and it's a fine, if you get caught. And very few people do, except that New York City actually has the highest arrest rate in the country for marijuana. Here, they don't arrest people for marijuana possession. It's called marijuana in public view.
Right, right.
And almost 90% of those arrests are all Black and Latino, almost entirely young men. And it is unbelievable that this is going on, number one. I mean, it's on top of the fact that the arrests are costing taxpayers millions of dollars and that it's a waste of time and a waste of resources. It's also, giving 40,000 young people a year a criminal record for something that it's outlandish. Now, I think you're right. There is an argument that can be made that particularly as it relates to medical marijuana, saying, look, we have patients, so not only are the opponents have to argue that they think that someone who has cancer or multiple sclerosis or another debilitating condition should be arrested for using something that works for them, but essentially what they're tacitly supporting is this regime of racial disparities and racial profiling in the policing system. And so that's one of the things we've talked about very explicitly in Connecticut. And in many ways it's really changed the debate, and it's left the opponents even more and more isolated and looking more and more ridiculous.
Now, Gabriel, one of the places that you and DPA are working right now is where some of the most striking racial disparity in prohibition enforcement exists in the country. I see a lot of data on this, but I was still shocked to see your information on New York State, where 93% of felony drug prisoners are of color, mainly African American. Now, this disparity really comes from the Rockefeller drug laws, which you're now working on repealing. Gabriel, tell us about the Rockefeller drug laws. How did they originate, and how are they working today?
The interesting part about the Rockefeller drug laws, and the reason that we argue that they have national significance, is that they were passed in 1973 by then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller. So the collection of laws that are known as the Rockefeller drug laws were passed by Rockefeller at that time. And the war on drugs as we know it today, you know, that was you know, certainly started by Nixon in the early 70s, but that was relaunched with much vigor by Reagan in the 80s. When Reagan did that, President Reagan at the time, he said he specifically cited the Rockefeller drug laws in New York as the model for the nation's drug war. And in 86, when Congress passed, you know, 23 new, or I think it was 26 actually, new mandatory minimums in the wake of the death of a basketball star in Maryland, from Maryland, Len Bias, they did that, and they based the mandatory minimum sentencing schemes on what exists here in New York, the Rockefeller drug laws. And so what we have here is this extremely harsh mandatory minimum sentencing scheme here for relatively low amounts of drugs. And while the prosecutors and many of the police and many of the tough-on-crime politicians, of which there are fewer and fewer here in New York that will argue this, but the argument in support of Rockefeller tends to be, we need to have these harsh laws so that we can protect our children and our communities, and we're locking up all these kingpins. But in point of fact, if you look at who's incarcerated, there's over 14,000 people that are currently incarcerated under these laws. The vast majority of them are first-time nonviolent drug offenders. They are, I mean, we could have the argument whether or not, you know, some of them, sure, they made a mistake and need to be held accountable in one form or another. But this, doing it this way has not only created a $500 million boondoggle for this state, for taxpayers in the state of New York, but it's also destroying communities across the state. See, when we have a situation where almost everybody that is locked up under drug felonies in New York are people of color, when we know from research around the world that drug use affects and drug abuse and drug addiction affects communities irregardless of race, class, gender, I mean, it's, you know, it, different people come to, or different reports come to different conclusions over who uses more and what the rates are, but it's genuinely or generally equal across racial categories around the country. And yet, here in New York, you know, the vast majority of people that are locked up, almost everybody, are people of color. It really is an apartheid system here. There's no other way to say it, and I don't think that that's an embellishment to use that word. That's a very politicized word and a very dangerous one, but I think it's also very descriptive of what's happening here. And so we've been pushing for years on trying to reform the laws. We say actually real reform, which has a number of components to it. There's four components to real reform, and we say unless those four components are met, it's not real reform. It's a waste. And we also say that real reform equals repeal. But we have not gotten there yet. And under a new administration here with Governor Spitzer, you know, who ran on a platform of saying, he said during his candidacy, we need to have real reform of the Rockefeller drug laws. We've heard absolutely nothing from him since he took office in January. Absolutely not a peep. And so we, you know, advocates like us and the movement here in New York, we're furious. We're absolutely furious because it's just impossible for any democratic government in anywhere in the world, let alone here in the United States, which is supposed to be the beacon of human rights and freedom, to, on the one hand, be parroting those types of words and saying we have a great democratic government here and so forth, and on the other hand, have almost everybody that's locked up under our drug laws be black and Latino. I mean, it's bad that anyone is locked up under the drug laws anyways. I mean, it's not like we should equalize it by arresting more white people. That's not the point. But the system here is, the racial disparities here and the racial targeting that happens under these laws we'd expect this to exist in a totalitarian fascist state or in an apartheid state, not in a democratic one.
And Gabriel, when it comes to this really racist policy and enforcement of prohibition, you know, why doesn't it get more media buzz? I mean, we saw Don Imus get fired for 15 seconds of racist speech on the radio. Why doesn't this 70-year-old policy of racist prohibition get more attention from folks like Al Sharpton and the like, or even from the mainstream media in general?
Yeah, that is an excellent, excellent question that we have raised time and time again. This, you know, Reverend Sharpton has actually come out a number of times on the Rockefeller drug laws, and I think the unfortunate and almost disgusting truth to the matter is that because it impacts black and brown people so horrifically, that it's simply not a news item. It's in New York, it's just not a news item. And we have done, I mean, last week we had a release on our website of Jim Jones, who's a very popular rapper. He had the number one song and album last year. He's from Harlem. He released a song and a video that we did on, we released it on our website about the Rockefeller drug laws. Now this is interesting for two reasons. One is that this is not a, you know, an underground artist. I mean, this is somebody who's gone platinum and is part of a very popular hip-hop crew in that's part of popular culture, popular within popular culture, that is releasing something about the Rockefeller drug laws. Now, that's very interesting in the drug war in general. The video is remarkable. People can see it on our website if they'd like to. But the second part that's interesting is that, you know, Jones himself was attacked during the IMIS scandal, saying, well, you know, these hip-hop stars aren't putting out, you know, good music, or they're using all this foul language and so forth, and why aren't people going after them? And I think the interesting part about this to me is something, a question that you just raised. Well, you know what? I'm not a big fan of a lot of foul music, whether that's hip-hop or rock or whatever else. I mean, there's a lot of trash out there. And sometimes there are some gems and so on. But the musicians are making music. Politicians are making these laws that are having a devastating impact on the communities from which these musicians come from, many of them, on generations of New Yorkers, on, you know, taxpayers. I mean, everybody is impacted by this. Now, if you don't like a song, you can turn that off on a radio. You don't like a policy, well, what are you going to do? And you're right, nobody is talking about that. And I think, unfortunately, it has everything to do with the fact of who it's impacting. Because if everybody that was locked up under the Rockefeller drug laws were middle-class white people or upper-class white people from the Upper West or Upper East Side, they would be repealed in a heartbeat. We wouldn't have the problem that we have now. But that's not the case. They're coming from communities that are low-income and that are populated majority of people of color. And so it can be ignored.
And Gabriel, this has been the busiest state legislative reform season in memory, with marijuana bills coming before 18 states. So what do you attribute all this activity to, and does it perhaps signal a broader change?
I think that in one respect, I think the drug policy reform movement to end the war on drugs, you know, should take a step back and say, you know what, we are actually moving some things forward here. I think we've gotten much more sophisticated in what we do and the way that we do it. And I think that given the extraordinary state of affairs that currently exists in the country now with this war that's going on in Iraq and the problems we're facing here domestically, I think that there's a real opening politically to do some of these reforms. I think that the people who have been in power for much of the last few years on the federal level, and the Republicans and that level of the right wing, have lost so much of their credibility that, you know, when we are dealing with representatives from the drug czar's office in any of the states that we are in, you know, they are making these claims that are utterly ridiculous. I think that's an indication, anyways, that we've certainly got the upper hand with regards to the science and the background and the community support on many of these issues. I think the other thing is that the American public is increasingly tired of the drug war attacks on people, especially with regard to medical marijuana. I think that's probably the most wedge. If the drug policy reform has a wedge issue right now, it is medical marijuana, I think, because it is just, it's absolutely impossible for some of these demagogues to stand up and look at, you know, somebody, even like if you think about Angel Rage, and, you know, she just dropped her attempts to try to not die, you know, so she can continue to use marijuana. And even though she's lost in the courts and whatnot, I would venture to guess the public opinion is really on her side, because who can believe that here's something that can actually help a woman stay alive? All she's asking you to do is be able to use it based on her doctor's recommendation. And the feds are saying absolutely not. And it's the longer that they keep doing that, I think the more support we end up having. But I don't know exactly what the silver bullet is with this, or if there is one. I think it's a combination of things, and I think it varies state by state. I think federally, you know, we still have a long, long fight ahead of us on the federal level. It's, I mean, even with the Democrats in power, it's just extremely difficult to get anything done in Congress. Although I think a number of the groups that you named and others, you know, we do a great job at playing defense and stopping even more horrible things from being passed.
Mm-hmm.
But on the, you know, on the state level and on the city level, we're able to play offense in a much more aggressive manner. And I think that that's a lot of what's going on right now.
Now, to round things out today, Gabriel, I know you work on state policy, but I have been asking around, and I want to ask you, as the presidential politicking season has already heated up out there, who are some presidential candidates you have your eye on?
I haven't made a choice yet, but the people that I find most interesting right now, one, I think Ron Paul, the Republican from Texas, I think he is a very compelling figure. I'm really glad that he is in that race on the Republican side, because I'm hoping that in more of the debates he's just going to continue to force some of those other Republicans to respond to real issues in a real way. I have to say I like that Barack Obama is running, and I hope that in that process that there's a response, you know, by him at some point around drug war issues. I don't think that we've gotten that yet. So, you know, and I know that Kucinich is going to have his hat in the ring, and or does have his hat in the ring. And, I mean, he's fantastic on these issues. He doesn't get the support that I think that he deserves, but he's fantastic on these issues. So, you know, it's, I think we have, there's a range of interesting candidates. And, you know, in some ways a lot of this to me feels just like, good Lord, do we have to keep doing this again and again? Because it just seems ridiculous. But, you know, that's what it is. And, of course, so much of our time and the media space and everything gets dealt with dealing with these people as, you know, their personality traits instead of having anything to do with what their background is. I mean, the reason I'm interested in Barack doesn't have to do with who he is on a personality-wise. It has to do with the fact that he was a trained community organizer in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, extremely interesting that he's coming from that background. But, you know, how that plays out, I don't know yet. The reason, I think Ron Paul is interesting because he puts out really compelling positions on a range of issues, and he's consistent, and he's thoughtful, and he's smart. The rest of the humdrum about, you know, who has the nicest dog or where they went on vacation and, you know, what they bought their wife or husband for Christmas is, I think, totally distracting and designed to make sure that we never ask anything about the issues. So my hope with the presidential election is less about an individual candidate and more about, can we as a movement force one of these or all of these candidates to respond to America's longest running war, the war on drugs, and to not parrot, you know, the same, you know, for lack of a better word, crap that has come out about this for the past 25 years, which is more cops, more prisons, and more bull.
Well, thank you for weighing in on that today, Gabriel. I really appreciate you joining us again here.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again. Gabriel Saya is the director of the State Organizing and Policy Project at the Drug Policy Alliance. We have links to their webpage about the Rockefeller drug laws on our website at normalaudiostash.com.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them bubonaya thing, yeah. War is not the answer. I want to know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. We said the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer.
And also joining us today is Ray Warren of the Marijuana Policy Project. Ray is the director of the state policies there, and we spoke to him yesterday about Vermont. Ray also answered some questions about the racial disparity of marijuana prohibition enforcement, and we'll highlight that today. But first, we posed a question to Ray about national politics as well. Now, Ray, I've been asking around. I want to ask you to weigh in on this as well. With the presidential politicking season off to a very early start this year, who are some presidential candidates of note? Who are you keeping your eye on?
Well, I have to tell you that one of the things I really like about being a Virginia resident myself is I don't have to register by party, and I try to keep a very bipartisan and very non-candidate specific view of the world. But I do have to say that I think Bill Richardson, the governor of New Mexico, did a great thing by signing the medical marijuana bill, and I think that was a wise move on his part for somebody who is not considered in the top tier of candidates to take a principled stand like that. I think that'll help him a lot.
So, you know, I wonder with Richardson showing such strong support for New Mexico's medical marijuana law, you know, is marijuana and medical marijuana something that might really help these candidates rise above their peers? And has it become an issue that is also a political asset now?
Absolutely. And I think there's medical marijuana is extremely popular in every state, and that's one of the education things we have to present to state legislators. But I think after a couple decades of a failed drug war, that reform in general is also fairly popular. And if more candidates would take that kind of stand that Bill Richardson did, I think they'll see that. Whether their pollsters will prevail, I don't know. But I agree with you. It could be a very popular breakout issue in what is otherwise sort of an undistinguished group. You have your Democrats have a certain – they're all saying the same thing. The Republicans are all saying the same thing. Here's an issue where a person can really stand out and say, hey, I have a different view here and make a difference.
And, Ray, we've also been exploring the question of racial disparity in prohibition enforcement here on the Audio Stash. I want to get your thoughts on this issue. Ray, do you think that it goes too far to say that those who support prohibition are essentially supporting racism in America?
Well, I think that's a particularly strong argument that we need to make and a point that we need to make. And in talking, for example, one of the state senators in Illinois who voted present recently on our bill, which means sort of neutral, I think this representative should have been with us, and he represented a predominantly African-American district, and I think that we didn't present that argument as we should have, especially as we move to the South, where a lot of legislators represent African-American constituents. I think it's important to present that argument and that fact, because there's also a counter-argument on the other side. A lot of representatives who represent those communities tend to be culturally conservative, and we have to explain, you know, this isn't just about culture and conservatism. This is about fairness and equality.
That was Ray Warren, the Director of State Policies at the Marijuana Policy Project. We have links to MPP on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.